don't want to necessarily just work with what you have and then create something that nobody wants. So you first find something that everyone loves. And then once you have that concept, then you have to think through pricing and then margins.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing SMB spend without buying an ERP. Today, I've got Kenny Jen from Quantify.us, and we're going to dive into today the art and science of vendor management. I meet a lot of people who say, yeah, I manage my vendors, but really all that means is they scream at people down the phone when things go wrong. And we all know that the textbook talks about building relationships, but I think Kenny is one of the few people I found that really has done that. And we're going to get into the investment and the payoff in that process. So Kenny, thank you very much for coming on the show. Maybe you could kick us off with telling us something about you that not many people know.
Yep. Great to meet you, James, and really happy to be on here. So I think I can start off with a fun fact on myself, which is that I'm a breakdancer. I've been breaking for over 18 years now, actually. And I think a unique way that I approach the dance is actually combining something that I do on my day-to-day in finance, which is I actually model out my dance combos on Excel. Oh. And in a very similar way as to how modeling is used, I name my moves and combos and put it together. So essentially it's a scenario build, and then I practice it, see whether or not it works, and then I'll change it accordingly. So it's very much like a budget versus actuals process.
You know what? I've asked a couple of people to tell something about you don't know, but this was the one that's knocked me over the most. Excel and breakdancing in one sentence. I love it. It's just brilliant. I'm going to tell everyone about this now. What did you make of the recent controversy in the Olympics?
Oh, very good. Yes. It was one of those things where the silliness of her performance, I think, almost outshines even the winning gold medalist. But, you know, I would say I've been in the scene for quite over a decade now, and it's still, I would say, a privilege to see the dance get as far as it has, the dance getting into the Olympics, and the fact that it actually got as far as ending up there, I think, still speaks a lot to how far the dance has been able to progress.
I'm sure it's done great. I didn't even know breakdancing was in the Olympics until that happened. And then I started Googling the dances and I was like, oh, this is awesome. You know, it probably did great a favor to the sport, maybe.
No, that's most definitely. I think it's also, at the very least, led to quite a few number of sponsorships, as well as, you know, a lot of people who have been trying to make a living off of it really take that opportunity and now become full-fledged athletes.
Okay. Now, using Excel to plan out your breakdance moves isn't the only time you use Excel. So maybe you could break us down a little bit of your credibility section here. Tell us a bit about your recent experience too, so that we know where you're coming from professionally.
Definitely. So as of right now, I am the co-founder of Quantify, which is a strategic finance firm that specializes in providing fractional CFO services to startups and emerging companies, particularly within the consumer packaged goods space, and as well as other sectors as well. And in terms of my history, I started off in investment banking, did that for a couple of years, really got into the fractional space in an interesting way through a venture capital fund that I worked for a couple of years. I had a chance to work with a lot of different companies at the same time, work with the management teams on their fundraising, strategic finance, board meetings, and so on and so forth. And then from there, really got tactical with applying a lot of the financial concepts into actionable day-to-day strategic moves with my time in a cannabis brand in Los Angeles, where I was managing the supply chain, product development, as well as the financial side of things. And then afterwards, I was a fractional CFO, as well as a financial leader for a number of companies at the same time, and ultimately ended up founding my own firm.
Okay, so cannabis is a very hot area and very touchy area. You have to be careful, I guess. And we're going to get into that a little bit later on. Let's start off with the supply chain. So supply chain for most people, I guess, and means dealing with overseas suppliers. What's your approach? Because you're sitting here in the US or Europe, you've got an idea for a product you want to bring alive. I guess you go on to AliExpress or Alibaba. I don't know what you do. Like, how do you get started with deciding I want to design something and bring it in for sale here?
Yeah, I would say really the first goal should be making a good product. So really thinking through what is the minimum viable means to develop something of which you know that customers are willing to pay and they are going to love it. I think starting from there is where you then work backwards into, well, how does now the supply chain work? Because you don't want to make, you don't want to necessarily just work with what you have and then create something that nobody wants. So you find, first find something that everyone loves. And then once you have that, once you have that concept, then it's, then you're, you have to think through pricing and then margins. Alibaba, definitely a great way to source some products. There's, you know, I think depending on the sector that you're in, as well as the materials that you're looking at, you can start doing some research as to the proper companies of which you'll find most competencies in terms of manufacturing. For example, with rolling papers and those types of materials, those tend to be pretty good in South America and Latin America as well. And for other materials, you may be able to find that in China. And then it really just depends on what you're trying to build there, as well as the existing manufacturers. It helps a lot to have a broker who is experienced with the network of factories that are within those regions.
Okay, that's interesting. So I wouldn't have thought of getting a broker, so but you'd recommend this. So let's say, okay, you need some tacit knowledge. And the first thing you said there, which makes sense from a startup world, is, you know, find out, don't just go and find something and then try and sell it to people who may or may not want it. You want to go the other way around. Does that mean you can do test runs, or how practically, how do you do that? Do you like come up with an idea, do a small test run, give it to people, then go back? What's your process?
Yeah. So when you really start thinking about the production side of things, a lot of these vendors will typically allow for the creation of samples and the test runs, right, as well, right? So the very important aspect of once you have a product in place is to go out and really source a bunch of, you know, whether it's through a broker or directly from the manufacturers themselves. But now you really have to get sample materials, ideally them allowing to provide you everything up to spec. So that way you can actually see what the end product may look like. And if they are willing to be a partner with you and they are interested in having your business, they should be able to at least get pretty far in terms of how close you are wanting it designed.
And how do those broker deals work? Do you put them on retainer, or where do you go to find them, for example? Where would you recommend to start finding good brokers?
I would really recommend, honestly, the network. There are potentially, you can certainly source them online. There's a lot of them that are posting online, but at the same time, there are many that are really just through personal relationships. A lot of the times, these factories may also be working through private contracts, and you may not really find out about them unless you know somebody who has a really good experience working with that particular factory. But at the same time, this is why brokers become so important, because they are in the know as to what kind of factories work with certain materials, the volume breaks, and the work style.
Okay, so if we take it a step before that, then you said, if you're listening to this and you're like, well, great for you, Kenny, you have contacts, but I don't. Are there like industry events you can attend? How do you start building a network to get recommendations like that? How did you build your network?
Yes. So industry B2B networks are always a great idea. A lot of them will be exhibiting at booths, and usually there's quite a few directories as well that you can start and reach out to. I would also recommend looking at products that are out there and brands that you may have connections with, and ask them yourselves as to who they've been using and where they've had success as well. A lot of brands who are already out there and scaled have gone through the painful measure of sourcing hundreds of vendors before they find someone that they actually work really well with. Okay. So it's definitely helpful to look at their scars and see if there's anything that they've come across that may actually work for yourself.
Okay, so you find maybe a product in the area you like, maybe look up on LinkedIn. Are you looking for kind of procurement officers or CFO? What's a typical title if you want to reach out to these people and try and build a relationship? Is procurement the right word?
Yeah, procurement is one. Usually those are pretty scaled teams at that point. You're working with companies that are already at, you know, maybe at least tens of millions of dollars to have a procurement person to manage all those vendors. If you're really looking for, I really recommend finding a product that seems and looks like the material that you're really trying to go for, and reaching out to CEO a lot of the times, especially if it's a smaller brand, you may want to look out for somebody who is also dealing with the same level of scale that you are.
Got it. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So not someone like 10 steps ahead, but one step ahead, because they're going to be have more empathy, probably more open to working with you or giving you a handout because they were where you are a while back.
Yeah, looking at comparable products, if they're using similar materials, reach out through LinkedIn and give me an earnest reach out, I find to be quite effective as well.
So when you're modeling, say, a product that you want to bring, you want to think, oh, I want to get this manufactured, etc. Are there benchmarks that you look for? Like you're saying, listen, we got to have at least 60% gross margin, or like when you must be sort of the brainstorming phase, you're thinking, oh, we could do this, we could do that. Are there financial metrics that you, rules of thumb that you're like, okay, I got to have at least these sort of metrics before we even start doing these test runs?
Yes, there do tend to be certain margin targets and rooms for cushion that you have to aim for. And usually I start with looking at comparable pricing amongst your competitor set. You want to be able to see kind of where your ceiling is, and then also based on where you are in the supply chain and where you expect certain spend categories to be, you can back into where your target margin is, right? So for example, if you're looking at retail in a retail channel and pricing is at $20, you may expect that wholesale selling to the retail channel is going to be 10. And then, you know, if you're looking at a certain, maybe like a half of that being related to sales and marketing, and then maybe another 20% being cost of goods, then you can essentially get 30% margin there.
And do you have a go-to, like going directly to retail or supplying into other as a wholesale distributor? What, where do you think, where's the easiest? I say easy money, there's no easy money, right? But like, is it easier to bring it all the way to the consumer, or is it smarter to try and sell into a retail chain, or how, what's your approach?
Well, I mean, when it comes to developing a new product, direct to consumer, I would say, has the closest connection to getting validation on the
Right.
success of your product, right? You
Okay.
have you have the possibility to get consumer data, you can see the relationship, and from there, you then go into retail.
And how much capital do you need to start it on one of these projects?
To really validate a product, you can likely hone something together. Depending on the product, it could be a couple bucks to a few hundred dollars to a few thousand, depending on the
Wow.
level of sophistication. In terms of creating something that people you want to use just to get out there and have a conversation with, really, I think it shouldn't be more than a few hundred dollars, depending on the quality of the product as well as the machinery that you're dealing with as well. Now, we're talking about bare bones minimum, something that you can see whether or not someone can give you feedback with, but it's also a very different story if you're now trying to look at a world where now it's polished branding with at scale, then that's a very different story.
Okay, and that's where I guess you want to bring in, if you are smart about it, if you can afford it, a fractional CFO to help you model that out and say, okay, I think I have something here, Kenny. You know, before you start committing, I'm guessing it's going to be tens of thousands of dollars at least to really go to scale then. Okay, but it's surprisingly cheap to get going. So you know, I'm kind of interested here. You're converting me from a software entrepreneur to a D2C. Let's see if how this goes. Now, we promised we were going to talk about vendor relationship. So let's say, okay, great, I've done my test market, I've hired a broker, seems like people are buying in my local market or wherever and distributing it. And now I'm going to the stage where, okay, you've got to decide to pick a supplier to work with. Now, I guess it would be nice if I could do it from all my behind my computer, but I get the sense that you kind of been starting investing in suppliers at that stage. So what's your approach to vendor management? Someone you know you're going to need to rely upon and deliver good service.
Yeah, this is coming from my experience during my time when I was in the cannabis company. I worked with up to 10 to 15 vendors at a given time, had a pretty sophisticated evaluation process for choosing which ones I ended up wanting to work with. And so usually that the product testing phase is where you're really able to tell the amount of commitment that these manufacturers are willing to give with you, as well as the amount of attention. So usually from the evaluation process, I'm looking at asking for product samples, and even based off of the way that they're interacting with me as to how far along they're willing to customize a product to see how close they can get to what I have in mind, or if they're just giving me their generic side production. I think it speak a lot to the amount of commitment that they're willing to do. You can also just tell by the way that they're communicating and prioritization of their meetings with you, as well as getting back to you that where you fall in how enthusiastic they are on you at becoming a bigger client down the line.
Okay, so this is starting to sound a bit like a recruitment process. So would you do like two or three samples of two different suppliers, or and then decide at that stage you're kind of, are you on the phone with them, or are you, how are you building, starting to build this relationship to, some of them rule themselves out, I guess, just by not being that interested.
A lot of the times it depends on the manufacturer, and sometimes you can't tell how they're managing the clientele as well. And so, you know, when you first reach out to them, I usually try to target at least 5 to 7 as a start and really just get an initial product sample, see how they are handling the intake, the responsiveness of the person who is assigned to me, whether it's the owner or potentially an account manager. Have a conversation with them as your timeline, how fast they can really get certain iterations, see if I have any critiques and commentary. I think one of the most important things is really how they respond to my feedback on the initial samples and how close they get to rectifying some of the requests for changes. And then from there, really, I would say a lot of it is a combination of phone calls and emails. So, you know, a lot of them will work with pretty differently, but usually I like working with them through video calls and phone calls, because now I can really get quite descriptive as to what I'm looking for in the specific measurements.
Okay. And is there a stage where, okay, so it's only a couple of hundred bucks each one, but you know, you want to do seven or 10 maybe samples. So maybe a couple of grand to get going at your initial phase. Then you get into, okay, you're down, we're ready. You had video and phone calls with people, so you're getting a sense of people. When do you get on a plane? That's what I'm kind of asking. Is it ever worth getting on a plane? Have you done that? And does it pay off?
Oh, we certainly have, especially when it comes to products that require a much more significant investment to really get it kicked off. Some goods require a tooling fee because their machinery can produce your good, but let's say you have a certain spec or you have a certain kind of dimension that requires a customized modification to the machinery that they have, then sometimes we may be willing to, especially if we're trying to go for a much larger scale, we may visit on site just to see what their supply chain looks like.
But do you have any tools you use to manage this contract? Are you doing it all on Excel and email, or is there like a contract management sort of solution in place, or is it all kind of done by hand?
There's quite a few vendor management tooling that's definitely available. At the time, I started off with Excel. It was my bread and butter, so I was pretty good with keeping that up to date. At a certain point, it can get pretty overwhelming, and if you're dealing with larger budgets and constant communications and different supply chains, I would recommend looking at other toolings as well. I've touched into Notion as a way to evolve my management skills, but you know, I would definitely say there's probably quite a few vendors now who are specialized in dealing with these day-to-day.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Like you got 15 vendors, you're trying to keep it straight. I mean, you need some sort of process there to keep on top of things. So let's get into some case studies here, because maybe show off how this can pay off, if you like. As a vendor in Hong Kong that you spent a good bit of time with, I believe. Tell us about how you build this relationship with these people in Hong Kong and how that's paid off. What sort of conversations do you have with them? Is it all business? How do you deepen that relationship so they are invested as new as you are in them?
Yeah. So usually for that vendor in particular, what we did was we started off with one particular SKU. We had them work on something that we were just about to launch. So there was a manageable amount of volume. Or actually another way that we were also evaluating them was we were creating a promotional sample to give out during B2B events. And so it was a volume of 500 to 1,000. It was a great way for us to kind of kickstart things, kick something off. Also a great sense as to how invested they are into seeing a longer term relationship. And so we sent them an initial design to create something on the smaller volume, see how it looks like for a smaller scale production. Had that sent over, we used it, ended up giving me a good experience. And so then from there, we just added on more SKUs, more volumes, and then eventually that relationship grew over time.
Sometimes you don't know whether you're working with a factory or a broker. I hear that come up sometimes. Have you had any eye-opening moments there when it comes to building that trust? I guess trust is the key thing here, right? You're in a foreign country, they're in a foreign country, but we're all people. But getting to that level, getting that to that human level is the opportunity, I guess. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, every industry has its own vendor ecosystem. And I'm really only just touching upon the packaging side of things. Right. The reason why I'm able to work with Hong Kong and have a level of trust with them is because that element is just for packaging. And so the relative ability to evaluate the product by stuff that they're sending over is much more defined. But say, especially in the cannabis industry, the vendors you're dealing with are called also be growers, co-packers, and of much more sophisticated processes. In that world, it's much more important to be in person and see the production process and to actually have sample runs that you might be having to see in person and to make sure that product quality is all up to snuff.
So we talked about the theory. Let's talk about the practice. You had to design some bottles, I believe it was a bottle. Maybe you could explain the process, like, and how did that go, and tell us about the people involved.
Yeah, so we were in the midst of creating a new drink. And so what we had to do was really have a product in mind, and it was all in our head, right? So we came up to the vendor and mentioned to them, hey, we wanted to create something that was pretty novel and new. Here's the design. And from there, they decided to provide us a few samples on a few ideas. So some of it was actually almost in creative process with them. They were able to show us, hey, here are the factories that we're working with and the type of bottles that are already standard. Try a few of these and see what may resonate with you or if you need something that's a little bit more custom. The reason why that's really important is because there is also a cost aspect to it. If you have a manufacturer that already produces some of these bottles at scale, then your unit cost is also going to be pretty advantageous. And you might also get some inspiration as to what can work that you did not originally have in mind.
And then one of the things that I'm doing, the closest thing that I do, which sounds similar to this, is recruitment. And I was like, if I do a paid piece or piece of work, if I ask someone to do like a portfolio piece, like I pay them for it, right? So I'm always like, I feel like some people will ask you to do sort of sample pieces without pay or whatever, but I don't like that. I like to stand out as an employer, if you like, as an employment opportunity by sort of, so I tend to be a little bit more generous on that side if someone has to do, if I ask someone to do anything. Is that a strategy that you use? Like, do you pay, are you not so uptight about getting things at the best price at this stage in order to build that relationship? Or is that setting an expectation that you're going to be paying over the odds later on when it comes to the full run?
I think it is really important to get a sense as to what their pricing may look like at scale, right, and then potentially start with subscale. So there is still, once again, a market validation aspect. And market validation can exist at several levels as well, right? You can make the base product and then have it out to your friends and family or certain random customers and they really love it. And then the next step is to test what it looks like on a certain channel, whether it's retail or scale direct to consumer, and then see whether or not that works. There's a lot of small details that people tend to overlook when it comes to scaling up that validation. For example, when you are going to retail, how the packaging may look on the shelf, it may be a very different tactic than, say, you're giving it out at a booth. Because when you're looking at it at the shelf, it also has to be in perspective of what your competitors are also designed on as well. And if you have a monochromatic color and everything else looks the same, you're not going to be able to stand out. Same thing with also if you're designing something that's for Amazon. You also have to think about the perspective of when someone is scrolling through that, whether or not your product does have that level of differentiation, which are small details that I think most operators don't realize can be punitive in terms of the design until they actually have it on there and they don't see the result, and then they have to wonder and investigate what's going on. And that is why I'm of the fan that it's okay to be playing at not ideal margins at subscale, as long as it's for, you're paying for a specific purpose.
Okay, you said something I think we can all learn from there, which is we tend to think of our products like in a vacuum, but the consumer has a choice, whoever that consumer is. They're going to be looking at you versus, like, they're going to be looking at us versus Purify or Precore or the other products out there. And if you look at it at that scale, you suddenly go, hold on, we all look the same. We all use the same colors. We all have a similar name, speaking for a friend here. And then you realize, well, sometimes that happens to us, like people coming, oh, I'm going to get working with you. I can't wait to start working with Purify, you know? And I'm like, we're not Purify. We're the other people, you know? But we didn't think about that when we were starting out. So
there's somebody who had mentioned to me one time, and I really always kind of, it always kind of stuck with me, the importance of not just product market fit, but product channel fit as well.
Right.
And how you have to always think through the lens of how a person is experiencing your product throughout the entire aspect of the life cycle, including how they enter the channel as well and how they would come across.
Yeah, I like that a lot. So you worked, let's talk a bit about your CBD experience, because this is, you know, it's in a market that's totally exploded the last few years. My sense is that the shine is, not the shine is coming off, but a lot, you know, it's been kind of established market now or growing for 5 years, am I right? Now, like, what's happening in early 2025? How has that market matured? And what are the issues that you have to watch out for when you're building products in this area?
Yeah, the recreational cannabis space has been quite fascinating to follow. I've been following it since I was in high school. So really, there was, I would say, a big catalyst that had happened was really in 2020 when COVID had hit. And in a lot of states like California, dispensaries were deemed an essential business. And that really, I would say, created a catalyst for legitimization, as well as people suddenly adopting the cannabis use during COVID.
Interesting.
And so from there was, I think, an explosion of adoption at the time, and a lot of brands were coming into the space. And from there, I would say there was a lot of increased production. Companies were really proliferating into the space. And sometime, you know, you've seen in the most recent years that demand has tapered off a bit and has not really kept up with the lofty expectations as to where a lot of these companies were forecasting. And so they had these enormous grows, creating tons of product that ultimately did not fit where they thought the market was going to be. Partly related to the fact that they thought legalization on the national level in the United States was going to happen at that point, which was a big impediment. And I think another big aspect to the difficulty on the CPG side for cannabis has been the lack of distribution. You have to be a licensed operator to legally distribute recreational cannabis products. So the amount of distribution that you're able to have is also limited by the number of dispensaries that are licensed within a certain state. Now, the problem with that is you now have the product channel experience is now very nuanced. A consumer has to be able to go to a dispensary to then go purchase the product. When you look at typical CPG, food and beverage, it's the key part is availability. There's a grocery store in every corner, a convenience store everywhere. And so it's not really restricted to a certain channel. That allows for trial as well as an ability to experience a product a lot more. Now you're thinking a lot more about how you're able to get their attention in areas that they're already at. Whereas with cannabis, there's also an element of having to get their attention to come to a dispensary and then make that purchase. So in 2025, I think the big trend that is happening is really the adoption of Delta 9 THC products, which is taking advantage of a loophole in the Farm Bill in the United States, which allows products to contain less than 0.3% THC. Now, the nice thing about it is that for beverages and gummies, which do weigh more in terms of, you know, in terms of dry weight, so to speak, you're able to create low-dose cannabis products that are technically legal to distribute within online and retail channels. That is a huge difference because now distribution has opened up and now you're really competing not just within other cannabis products, but with other, you know, alcohol alternatives, really.
So does that, I've heard for some reason everyone's talking about microdosing on the podcast recently. Does that fit into this term? I was wondering why is everyone talking about microdosing all of a sudden? But then if there's a commercial reason, right? There's a channel that wasn't available before, so that's suddenly become more popular. I'm curious, like, if you're microdosing cannabis, like, does it work? Is it just like a low high or like a mellow, what is it? It's kind of a calming effect. It's not like a high you get from it, is it? But it's just like a...
Well, I guess there's a definition on what microdosing can be, right? With the Farm Bill and the allowance of Delta 9 THC products, with a typical beverage, you're able to put at least 5 to 10 milligrams of THC. Now, for a standard dose, it's about 5 to 10 milligrams of THC. So it's actually the ideal dose, almost the equivalent of, let's say, how a person may be drinking a beer. So that I actually think the allowance of that into the major retail channels would be quite a boon for the industry because it's a low enough dose that is, I would argue, able to be introductory for the mainstream audience. And if you look at dispensary products, a lot of it's very high dose. A lot of things of which you may be quite terrified to consume accidentally. So there is, for a lot of industry insiders, they see a bifurcation where high-dose products still remain within dispensaries, but then reasonable low-dose products can now stay within the mainstream space. So I think that kind of also kind of fits in terms of safety as well as the ability to touch the right audiences.
And is that a marketing, is that a market thing there? People are like, want a high-dose thing. Like, I feel like people are like, oh yeah, this is... That's a demand there. Because it's weird. People don't really say, oh, yeah, I suppose they do. They drink whiskey or whatever, you know, high volume, absolute volume stuff. But a lot of people are like, no, that's too much for me. So is it the market? Why are people so interested in this high dose approach if, you know, the micro dosing is basically the recommended amount anyway?
Yeah. So it has a lot to do with the dispensary behavior. So when you look at a person who is going to a dispensary habitually, those tend to be the consumers who are looking for high dose, high volume consumption.
Right.
And there was a big time in the market, sometime 2020 to 2022, where a lot of brands were trying to cater to the new age consumer, the soccer moms, who are more the who they assumed would be the low dose consumer. The problem was because of the way that distribution was, which is limited to limited licensed recreational dispensaries, these consumers were not going to the dispensary on their own. It wasn't part of their day-to-day. They made a huge bet on a consumer of which did not live up in terms of habitual behavior. A lot of these people, yes, they may go to a dispensary once or twice as a special occasion and purchase their products, but they're also low-dose consumers. So they're only consuming this periodically, and it's not part of the day-to-day routine. If it was at a Whole Foods, very different story, right? The availability is there. They can make impulse purchases. It's in front of them to really kind of display the packaging and the merchandising can really be in front of them. Whereas with a dispensary experience, you have to really reach them through some creative means. And they're not even allowed to do Google and Facebook. So they really have to kind of think outside the box to give them to come up with the occasion to drive themselves to a dispensary and then make that purchase.
So let's finish up here by talking about the finance, like running of one of these businesses from a finance perspective. I've heard that debanking or getting banked can be a problem sometimes. Is that true? Because sometimes some of these businesses still dealing in cash. find it hard to find a bank that's going to work with them. How's that working out right now?
Yeah, the real difficulty is the fact that most banks are federally regulated. And because cannabis is still, as of right now, a Schedule I substance by the federal government, a lot of banks are very cautious or not even allowed to bank cannabis companies. And so what has happened is, you're right, there is a tremendous amount of cash in this business. And those who are trying to alleviate themselves from that burden, they have to work with local credit unions who are willing or specialize in that and have the proper compliance procedures, or, you know, develop the proper product to then be able to properly service that part of the industry at a pretty exorbitant cost.
Okay, so you either spend the money on extra security in your premises, or you are going to get higher fees from these specialist providers. You've got to be aware of that.
You also have to be aware of the vendors and customers that you're dealing with. A lot of the times, some dispensaries may only be distributing and doing business in cash. So sometimes you may actually have to go to the dispensary itself and pick up the cash to then go deposit. Some of them are part of a larger network, and they may also have their own independent bank, of which then you can probably do some kind of level of wire transfer, as long as both of you have the level of proper compliance and banking partner that can do so.
Oh yeah, that hadn't even occurred to me. So is it difficult to accept consumer payments through credit card networks or through banking networks because of these regulations still? Do consumers still have to pay by cash or wire transfer?
It's a very tricky part of the industry. Credit cards are actually still not allowed because card networks are federal.
So right.
Visa and MasterCard do not allow cannabis transactions to be happening across your network. And a lot of dispensaries get punished if they try to do some kind of workaround. What a lot of dispensaries have done is this ATM approach, which, by the way, is also still completely illegal, but this is what you're going to see in most dispensaries, which is that you are using a debit card to purchase this transaction, but you're not actually making a direct transaction. You are making a withdrawal. So if, let's say, you have a $38 charge, you are making a withdrawal when you scan the card of $40, and then you're paying in cash $38 and getting $2 back in change.
Wow. Yeah. You can see why, if the federal change happens, this is totally going to change overnight of inefficiency and issues to work around. Not to mention with the history, I guess, you know, you still got cash, which means, you know, you got the black market still can get involved, I guess. And you still have that. As long as that's involved, it's not going to free the market to be fully legitimized, right? Like, so it's like
a big part of what makes the economics of recreational cannabis also so difficult is that because it's still a Schedule I substance, you cannot deduct expenses below gross profit in your taxes. So you're taxed at gross profit, which is enormous, right? So this is also why this movement into hemp-derived Delta 9 beverages is also a really big deal. Because if you're falling within that 0.3% THC regulation, you're technically selling it as hemp, which is legal in the United States. And so now you're not only able to expand it based on distribution channels, but you're also able to avoid taxes on gross profit. You're now able to deduct it like a normal business would.
That's a massive difference. That's insane.
Yeah.
Tax on your gross is, how can anything work like that?
Yeah. So there's very much a tale of two cities right now. And I would say some cannabis operators are really starting to move over to the hemp side of the business. But, you know, I'd say it's still a battleground right now because it's still to be determined as to whether or not they're going to close that loophole.
Okay. So what I'm getting from this is you definitely need someone you need a finance expert on your team for this, whatever about other types of products. You need someone. So how can people get in touch with you, Kenny, if they want to find out more or they want to go into more detail on one of these areas?
Yeah. They can feel free to reach out to us on our website at Quantify.us. So it's Quantify.us, or you can email me at Kenny@Quantify.us.
Thanks, Kenny. I've learned a lot in this one. It's a lot of fun, from breakdancing to cannabis and bottles and everything in Hong Kong, everything in between. It's been a fun conversation. And thank you for listening to the podcast. If you got this far, your special reward is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. We have a program in there with a webinar, shows you my take on how fractional CFOs can better market themselves. Not all of them are as well-spoken as Kenny here, and sometimes they struggle to fully explain the value that they can bring to a business, which is insane in my mind. So if you're a fractional CFO, please sign up over there. And that's it. Thanks, Kenny. I've enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
I've had a blast, James. Thanks for your time.